and the horses and the applause outside. Although Edgar did not complain, Maria finally could not take it.
"Let us see the parade," she told him.
"Ah," he replied, "I can't go down 5 flights of stairs."
"No," she said, "but I can carry you up one."
It was 1 flight to the roof, and even though Edgar was not a small man, Maria had been carrying him in all of the other ways for 30 years. She put her arms around him, chair and all, and she carried him from the apartment and up the stairs. As the revelry grew louder outside, Maria climbed faster, fearing that she would not get to the top before the parade was over. Filled with passion by the sensation of being carried by his wife, Edgar told Maria that she needn't hurry on his behalf. This 2-person parade in the stairwell was far better than anything he might see outside. It was not that Edgar had stopped loving Maria at any point during that fraught decade of their marriage, but he had stopped saying that he loved her. Maria was so overcome by these words of his that she placed her foot wrong on the top stair. The two of them pitched backward, and surely Maria would have died from the fall if Edgar had not broken her fall somewhat. As it was, she only broke her leg, the opposite leg from her husband, and he only got a bruise on his chest where she had landed. Maria could not work now either, and the Lopez household suddenly became all dependents and no laborers. They came to the end of their money. They promised the rent, and promised the rent, and then they came to the end of their promises. They should have been thrown out on the street, but the landlord was kindly, and the Lopezes had been good tenants for years until now. Moreover, he noted, he had a shy son with no luck in the lady department, and he had noticed that Marisita had become a clever and lovely young woman. He suggested, if Marisita was agreeable with it, of course, that the two of them might meet. Possibly love would bloom. The rest was left unspoken, of course. If love bloomed and a marriage came of it, he would not throw his in-laws into the street. Marisita agreed to meet the landlord's son. She had been, she remembered, both nervous and excited. Their landlord was a kind man, and there were many reasons why in San Antonio in 1961 he would not have been excited to introduce his son to the daughter of his Spanish-speaking tenants. And he did it anyway, without condescension. Either his son would be obviously unsuitable, or he might be marvelous and save them all. But the problem was that he was neither. His name was Homer, and he was neither handsome nor ugly. He was neither terrible nor wonderful. He was shy and awkward, a little shorter than Marisita, a little sweatier than Marisita. He fell madly in love with her straight away. Marisita did not fall in love with him, neither straight away nor after several weeks of courting. Now, this was no arranged marriage. No one was forcing the two together. She could have walked away. But every evening she would return from cruising with Homer and find Edgar in his chair with his leg elevated, and Maria in the chair opposite with her leg still in its cast, holding hands across the space between them, and she would see her sister sleeping sweetly in their beds in the next room, and they would ask her how it went, and she would have to say,
"Wonderfully."
She could not let them down. And so the wedding was set. Marisita tried to fall in love with Homer, and then she tried to convince herself that she did not need true love to be happy. And finally, she dreamed that she might not live to be very old, and perhaps in the next life she could have her life for herself. She cried when no one could see her, and smiled and laughed when they all could. The wedding was to be held in the Cathedral of San Fernando, a location made possible only by the landlord's connections. It was a grand old building, constructed in the early 18th century. White pillars held up the roof, and white beams arched down the ceiling like a whale's ribcage. Any bride would have been happy to be married in such an awe-inspiring space. It was a place for an epic love story. But Marisita was not in an epic love story. Homer stood at the altar and waited for her with the priest. Marisita stood at the doorway. Edgar was on her arm. He could not walk well, but he would limp down the aisle to give his daughter away if he did nothing else. Marisita could see her mother's face at the very front of the church, and she heard her little sisters laughing around her as they waited to follow her with flower petals. Max was not sitting, as he had thrown a fit over his suit and was waiting outside for someone to fetch him and tell him that he had been right all along and please would he come inside. Marisita looked at her family, and she told herself that she was saving them all. Her tears welled inside her, but she held them back and reached for a smile. She could not find it, and so she ran. She ran out of the church, and her father couldn't follow her because of his bad leg, and her sisters were too shocked to realize that she didn't mean to stop, and Max let her go because he never chased anything but his anger. So Marisita ran and ran and ran. She ran all through her wedding day, and all through her wedding night, and another day, and another night, over and over, holding up her wedding dress in both hands, crying over how she had betrayed them. Then she found herself in Bicho Raro, and the miracle rose up inside her. Chapter 28. That is when you receive the miracle, Joaquin said. He was using his Diablo Diablo manner with great effort, because he, like everyone else listening, was quite affected by Marisita's tale. He and Pete and Beatrice gazed at the closed doors of the box truck, imagining Marisita standing on the stage outside it.
Yes,
Marisita confirmed. She was crying again now, but she spoke through the tears. One cannot always hear tears on the radio, but they were audible in this instance. Not the ones that fell, because those were still drowned out by the rain always falling on her, but the ones that choked in her throat. Joaquin wished that Marisita's family could have heard her tell her version of the story, just as Robbie and Betsy had heard each other's letters the night before. But they were hundreds of miles away, so he simply continued.
And it was sometime after this Daniel helped you?
Marisita whispered.
I knew he was risking himself.
She felt sure that the Sorias would despise her in the next few minutes, if they didn't already hate her after hearing how she'd betrayed her own family. But she pressed on.
We knew we weren't allowed to speak, but sometimes he would come to my kitchen and just sit while I cooked. I didn't cook for him, I knew that wasn't allowed, but sometimes, after he left, I would realize that there were a few bizcochitos or churros missing, and then I just started to make them for him and leave them where he could steal as many as he liked. And I knew we were not supposed to speak, but sometimes I would go to the shrine and pray in the garden with him. He was not supposed to give me anything, but sometimes he would leave little things there for me to pick up. Just thread for my sewing, or a little harmonica, or a bird's nest that he had found. We didn't speak. We knew we weren't supposed to speak. We knew we weren't supposed to be together at all. But finally, we began to walk into the desert together. We didn't speak. We knew we shouldn't. We knew we shouldn't.
That crazy fool, Joaquin said.
That crazy fool,
Marisita agreed.
And we broke that rule too, eventually. We spoke. Just a few words here and there. More every time that nothing terrible happened when we did. I know we were fools. I know how it sounds. I'm so sorry.
This apology meant nothing to Diablo Diablo and everything to Joaquin and the rest of the Sorias, but not for the reason Marisita thought. Contrary to what Marisita feared, none of them were angry with her, and none of them hated her. They did not need this apology to make her actions right, but it still meant something to them that she cared enough about them to offer it. Generously, Joaquin said, "It was him as well as you, Marisita. Always take blame for your own actions, but never take blame for someone else's." "Was this when his darkness fell?"
"No," Marisita said.
"Well, I don't understand why not."
"Because he hadn't helped me yet," Marisita said. "He hadn't interfered. I wasn't any closer to the second miracle just because I fell in love with him. In fact, I only felt worse. Daniel is so good, and he loved his family so much. It only made me think about how I hadn't heard from my own family. How could I have? I assume they've been thrown in the streets. They must hate me. I've put them through so much humiliation. I failed them. I didn't even save myself, and so all I have is this guilt."
"But this is an outrage," Joaquin said. Beatriz and Pete furiously wrote messages to Joaquin and held them up for him to read them. "What about this brother of yours, Max? He should be carrying the guilt." "Yes, all of us in the studio agree that he's the villain."
"He was just so angry," Marisita said.
"So am I," Joaquin said, "at Max."
"If you'd met him..."
"I'd be angrier. Tell us what happened that night, the night Daniel came to you."
On that night, Marisita had decided to walk into the desert until she could no longer walk. She had been contemplating it for weeks, and it was not an easy decision to make. It was the ultimate in failure, the ultimate imperfection. But it was made, or it had been, until Tony and Pete arrived, interrupting her. Now she could not go until the dogs had settled and Pichoraro had fallen back to sleep. Even this small delay destroyed her, and she curled on the floor of her home and sobbed. Deep down she knew that walking out into the desert still did nothing for her family. It was merely another selfish act. In the end, she still thought only of herself. If she wanted to truly cure her family's woes, she would return to them and beg for Homer's forgiveness. Even in this moment of despair, she could not make herself do that. Self-hatred and rain poured around her. She had not been dry or warm in months. Slowly, the commotion outside died down. The dog's barking vanished into the night. Engines were silenced. Voices rose and fell. Owls screamed and called and finally fell silent. The night was quiet. A knock came on Marisita's door. She did not get off the floor, nor did she answer. A moment later, the door cracked open and footsteps came to her. They stopped beside her, and the owner of the feet stood there for a very long time. This was because it was Daniel, and he was still wrestling with himself over what he wanted to do and what he was supposed to do. With a heavy sigh, he curled himself around her. This was not allowed, to embrace her like this, but he did it anyway. The rain fell on her, and the rain fell on him, and they were both soaked to the skin. In this moment, the scent of rain mingled sweetly with the scent of the shrine's incense, and Marisita remembered what it was to be warm and safe. Then Daniel did what he would do for her if she had not been a pilgrim, as if he was not afraid. Still holding her tightly, he spoke into her ear. He told her that she could not hold herself responsible for all of her family's financial woes, and that it was not her place to be the sacrificial lamb. There were other solutions, but her family had settled on the easiest and ignored the signs of her unhappiness.
Moreover, she was honorable for not giving herself to a man who she couldn't love. Homer didn't deserve to live a lie.
But they didn't make me, Marisita had told Daniel. They were not cruel. I was at fault for not going through with it, or not telling them sooner that I couldn't.
You can forgive yourself, Daniel had insisted.
I don't think I can, she replied.
He continued to hold her.
I know everything feels wrong, but you can be right again, Marisita, if you try as hard at it as you try with everything else.
This was when the black rose of his darkness had bloomed. Neither Daniel nor Marisita knew what part of that visit triggered it, but the truth was that it was not Daniel coming to comfort her, nor the sensible counsel he gave. It was not his arms around her, or the warmth of his words in her ear. It was, in fact, the way that he had said Marisita to her in this last sentence. The way he said her name conveyed all of his sympathy, and it confirmed all of the truth of his advice, and it promised her that she was worthwhile and redeemable, and it indicated that he treasured the way he had seen her selflessly interact with the other pilgrims, and it hinted that if any single thing was different about their circumstances, he would marry her immediately and live with her for decades until they died on the same day, just as in love as they were in that moment. This may seem like a lot to be contained in the single word that is a given name, but this is why, in more conservative times, cultures took great care to refer to each other by Mr. and Mrs.
And then he left, Marisita said.
Joaquin was too overcome by his cousin's bravery to immediately answer. Right then, he was so ferociously proud and scared for Daniel that love and hope and fear choked his Diablo Diablo voice from him. With great effort, he managed to say only,
"We're going to take a brief musical break. Here's Elvis with Can't Help Falling in Love."
While Elvis crooned, Joaquin held himself and wiped away a tear, and Pete and Beatriz looked steadily at each other because stories about lovers always hit other lovers hard. Joaquin pulled himself together as the song drew to a close.
"Now we're back. Thank you, Elvis, for singing the words we were all thinking."
And the darkness?
"I don't know when it came upon him. It must have been soon after he left, because he returned only a few minutes later with a letter for Beatriz. He slid it under the door and gave me the instructions for the letter. Then he was gone. And I never got to tell him myself that I love him."
There was silence.
Joaquin said, "If he is listening tonight, you just did."
Marisita said nothing.
Joaquin said, "Marisita?"
"It's just..."
Marisita started.
"Yes?"
Marisita held out her hands to the sky and examined them again.
"It's just... that the rain has stopped."
Chapter 29. Of all the Sorias there, only Luis the One-Handed had ever been in Michoacán at the time of the great monarch butterfly migration. Millions of butterflies travel to Mexico each fall, sheltering in the forest there as winter punishes the land farther north. It was a sight he would not soon forget. The air shimmering with drifting color, the butterflies floating on wings that looked like Antonia Soria had cut them at her kitchen table. Some people said that these butterflies were the souls of the dead, returning to earth in time for Dia de los Muertos, but Luis had thought he had never seen anything so alive. He hadn't believed he would see anything like it again, but on that charged night, the Sorias found themselves gazing at a sky that rivaled that enchanted one. Once the storm had ceased over Marisita, it took only a few moments for the butterflies on Marisita's dress to dry. Now, they took off all around her, hundreds of them, swirling up and around into the sky. They mingled with the miracle-crazed owls who circled and dove, driven to excitement by Marisita's miracle. It was an awesome sight, but a charged one. Miracles are a strange thing in that sometimes a miracle will trigger another one, or sometimes trigger a disaster, and sometimes both of these are the same thing. So when the butterflies swelled upward, dots of orange and yellow, they flew right into that atmosphere that had begun the night so charged with anticipation and fear and hope. Those molecules vibrated and agitated as hundreds of wings brushed against them again and again, and in the black sky, an electrical charge mounted. The Sorias could hear it down below. Their ears momentarily went dull and dead in anticipation, and then there was a mighty crack, as though the sky itself was ripping open. A massive lightning bolt flew from the dark. Lightning hunts the largest prey, which in this case was the antenna on top of the radio telescope, with Tony as its human base. There was an explosion of light. The antenna and the dish and Tony were all obscured by it. Everyone down below was forced to avert their eyes lest they be blinded. In less than a second, the electric pulse raced white-hot down the wires that ran from the antenna to the truck, and every ground wire exploded from the soil with a sizzle and pop. A thunderous crash shook the ground they stood on. When the air cleared, there was no sign of the antenna. The telescope dish was blackened. Tony was stretched out in the dust at the base of the dish, the remains of the antenna blasted in copper bits around him. He was no longer a giant. He was not currently breathing. Before the lightning strike, as Tony had listened to Marisita's confession, he had been looking down from this very great height onto Bicho Raro, and he had been thinking about the enormity of what they were doing tonight, and how this entire family had come together to do it. He was thinking about Joaquin's incredible promise. And finally, he was thinking that it wasn't all bad being a radio giant, as long as you looked for the things you could do as a giant that you couldn't do as anything else, like hold up someone else's voice so it was just a little louder. The second miracle had come easily. "Tony! Gosh, Tony!" Pete said. "What do I do?" Joaquin, who had torn off his headset to jump from the truck, put his ear on Tony's chest, trying to hear his heart or check for breathing. This is a terrible way to check for evidence of life. Beatrice, who had leaped out with Pete and Joaquin, did it in a less terrible way. She lifted Tony's hand, noticing the branched and peculiar lightning flowers that covered his arm, ending at his fingers. "There's a pulse," she said. "He's alive." It's a difficult thing to be struck by lightning. It's also a difficult thing to fall dozens of feet from the top of a radio telescope. Tony's breath had been knocked all the way out to the highway, and it took a full minute for it to make its panting way back to him. "He's breathing," Joaquin announced for the benefit of the other Sorias. But they were not paying attention to him. They were shouting and pointing at something completely different. The box truck. Because Pete, Beatrice, and Joaquin had jumped out of the box truck so swiftly to attend to Tony, they had not realized that the truck had become extremely warm immediately following the strike. The lightning had raced on the wires so hot and ferocious that it had lit everything it touched on fire. The box truck had been quietly and furiously burning to the ground in the minutes they were distracted by Tony. Beatrice said, "Save the transmitter!"
"I'll get buckets from the barn," Pete said.
"I'll help," said Antonia.
"Yes," agreed Michael.
Anyone who has fought a fire of any size knows that there are some fires you can kill and some fires that will die only on their own. This was the latter. The interior of the truck was an inferno. The smell of melting electronics filled the night as clouds of dark smoke blocked out the stars. As buckets were passed from hand to hand, and precious water poured out on the sand, the fire popped and groaned and hissed like the living thing it was. The egg Beatrice had hung in a hairnet nest began to agitate and scream. It had never grown warm enough to incubate and hatch, but now, finally, in this miraculous destructive fire, it cracked open. A strange dark owl of a breed none of them had ever seen burst from the fire. It circled around their heads once, and when it looked down, for a moment, its paler face looked like a woman's, a little like Loyola Soria, and a little like the face of the sculpture in the shrine. Then the owl was gone, and the truck was, too, singed to smoldering ashes. It is difficult to give up hope, particularly when you have just been filled with a lot of it, particularly when you have gone without for so long. Humans are as drawn to hope as owls are to miracles. It only takes the suggestion of it to stir them up, and the eagerness lingers for a while, even when all traces of it are gone. And the Sorias were riled up over more than just a suggestion. Marisita's second miracle had happened right before their eyes, and then Tony's had too. They finally, truly believed what Beatrice and Joaquin had posited. For years, they had been doing it wrong. The danger had been real, but the taboo had not. Now they imagined a generation of pilgrims coming and learning from previous pilgrims, and from Sorias, and from the indefinable wisdom that comes from music, even if the words don't always sink in. So when the box truck burned to the ground, they did not immediately realize that something had died with it. It occurred to Beatrice first.
"No,"
she said, just one word. To communicate with Danielle, they would need another radio, and she could build one, but it would require new parts. New parts would require a trip to Alamosa at best, ordering them from elsewhere at worst. It would mean she had to build a new antenna. Even with all the help of everyone here in Bicho Raro, it could not be done in a day, or even 2 days. She had seen Marisita return home that day with Danielle's bag. He didn't have 2 days. He didn't have 1 day. He might not even have had this day. Now that the owls and butterflies had dispersed, there was only one species left soaring overhead. Vultures.
"Where is Marisita?" asked Judith.
Marisita was gone. Now that she was healed, her shame and guilt gone with the rain, she found that her desire to find Danielle remained. She was determined to find him and offer the same comfort that he had given her. This struck Beatrice as the ultimate folly. It seemed obvious to her that if Marisita had not found Danielle before now, there was no reason why she could hope to find him in the midst of an ashy black night. And so, in this moment of terrible loss and hardship, Pete and Beatrice did what lovers often do when things are the worst for the other. They fought. It was made worse by neither of them realizing that they were fighting. Instead, they thought they were being quite reasonable. "I can't believe it's gone," Pete said. Beatrice said,
"It will take me weeks to rebuild it."
"Oh, I just meant the truck."
Pete felt blindsided by the sudden loss of his future, a loss that Beatrice pointed out was only a loss in his mind, as he did not need a moving truck to be a whole person, and in fact only required a sense of worth, which was something that came separate from a job title or being shipped off to another country to shoot at people like your father or father's father had been before. This did not, as you might imagine, make Pete feel any better, as very few people are ever healed by being told the truth instead of feeling the truth for themselves.
"You don't have to be cruel about it," Pete said. "I know you're upset."
"I'm not upset. Please stop saying that I am."
She sounded so certain that Pete regarded her fresh, trying to understand if he was reading her wrong. Her expression was complicated by the ash on it, and she did not wear her feelings like anyone else he had met, but he felt strongly enough about it to press on, with sympathy.
"Look, you're allowed to be upset. All this, the fire, Danielle, you're allowed."
"I don't have feelings like that."
"Don't have feelings like that," Pete echoed. "You're not a doll. You're not a robot."
"I'm trying to tell you something about myself," Beatrice said. "You're wrong."
But Pete was not wrong. He had not been wrong before when he'd said it, and he wasn't wrong now. If only Beatrice believed her strangely shaped feelings existed, she would have seen it too. Instead, she found herself impatient with him, thinking about how Francisco and Antonia's relationship had fallen apart because they were too dissimilar. Pete, she thought, was merely proving how he was an emotional being and unable to see her for how she truly was, unable to understand what she was unable to give him. She believed that this conversation was exactly why people like her father and Beatrice ended up alone in greenhouses with their work. She didn't realize that she was being torn to shreds inside.
"I don't need to be made into something that I'm not," she said. "Something easier, with feelings, something more like you. I am trying to think of what to do next, and it's taking all of my mind, and I don't need you to imagine me as something softer to make you feel better about who I am."
Pete stared at her, but she didn't soften these words, because she fully believed them. And because she fully believed them, he thought that he must have been wrong. She knew herself better than he did. As her eyes glittered coldly at him, he waited just a moment longer to see if there was any feeling or kindness in them, but she believed herself the girl without feelings, too much for that. Behind him, the box truck he had wanted so badly smoldered. His heart lurched dangerously, a pit inside him, the hole enormous and irreparable. He turned without another word, and he left Bicho Raro.
Chapter 30 Francisco Soria had begun work on his marvelous greenhouse directly after an early fight with Antonia. She had been shouting at him as she had shouted at him each day for months, and he had realized all at once that he had nothing to say to her in response, not only for this current argument, but for all of them. Rather than wait for her to finish so he could explain this truth to her, he had merely walked out of their house into the bright day and begun construction. Antonia had found this impossibly cruel, but Francisco had not left to hurt her. He had left to ease his own mind. Too much noise and too much anger acted like a flu on his thoughts, and as Antonia's grief overtook her, his ideas had been choked down to only a tiny flame. And what was he, if not made purely of ideas? In those early months, he had worked on the greenhouse's construction entirely after dark, when every other Soria was asleep, because he found that, having lived with so much noise for so long, he hungered for absolute silence. It was only after many days of quiet that his prized fluidity of thought had slowly built back up again. Once he had finished the greenhouse and begun work on his roses, he finally returned his schedule to a diurnal one. In this way, he lived a small and solitary life in a small and controlled world. It was not his best life, but it was an acceptable one. In the ruins left behind after the truck had burned down,
Beatrice found that her small and controlled world was denied her. The radio dish was still smoking hot, and the truck had burned to ashes. There was no private place she could climb on or under. Beatrice's mind refused to settle, though, and eventually she went to the only sanctuary she could think of, the little house Pete had built. There she sat inside the dark. There was only a little porch light coming through the windows, the glass still filtering the handsomeness of thought from her father's greenhouse. She curled her arms around her knees and struggled to piece together a solution to reach Danielle, but her thoughts would not order. She tried to cast them up above her, outside of her head and into the sky, so that she could study them from all directions, but they refused to leave her body. She kept testing her thoughts on branches of logic, and finding the logic would not hold. She had been sitting there for countless moments when she heard a whistle. "Beatrice," whistled her father gently. She did not respond, but he ducked his head and entered anyway. He had already, through process of elimination, decided that she must be in the house. He drew close enough that she came into view, still an owl-like in the corner. Father and daughter did not embrace or touch, but he sat close to her, facing her, mirroring her posture.
"What are you doing?" he whistled to her.
"Thinking of how to reach Danielle before it's too late."
It was not so much a whistle as it could have been, but he understood her.
"There was no way to save the truck," he said.
"I know."
"Pete has gone," he said.
"I know."
There was a long moment of quiet.
Because they were both good about being quiet, it is difficult to say just how long this moment actually lasted. It was shorter than the night, but not by a lot. Finally, Francisco said very softly in words, not whistles,
"I believe that we have been wrong about many things."
When Beatrice didn't answer, he said,
"I'm moving back into our house."
Then he patted her knee and stood up and left her there. Beatrice began to cry. She had not known that she could cry, and she did not know why she was crying, and she did not realize that this in many cases is just how crying goes. She cried for a very long time, and then she thought about how she had told Pete she was not upset when she had been the most upset she had ever been in her life. And then she thought about the vultures and Marisita, and she cried even more. Finally, she thought of how they had been wrong about the taboo for so long, and it was probably going to cost Danielle's life. When she was done crying, she wiped her cheeks, the dry air took away all the tears she had missed, and the girl with strange feelings saddled up Salto and rode into the desert to find her cousin. Chapter 31. Riding astride Salto, Beatrice followed the buzzards, and soon she caught up with the owl she had seen hatch from the egg in the fire. It coasted overhead with unshakable certainty, and Beatrice felt positive no owl would travel with such surety unless it was headed toward a miracle or a disaster. And what other miracle or disaster could be taking place in this valley tonight but something having to do with the former saint of Bicho Raro? As she rode, she wondered what she would do when she found Danielle. She had water and a little bit of food, but she did not know what to expect. The stars stopped their laughing to watch her gallop beneath them, and the moon covered its face with a cloud. And then, as she grew close, the stars scrambled down below the horizon so that they would not have to watch. The sun delayed its rising, too, so as not to bear witness, hesitating just at the edge of the earth, so the early morning hung in an eerie half-light. The buzzards and pale-faced owl all gathered in the same place, a low, flat area of scrub with a dune pressed up against an overgrown barbed wire fence. In this place, Beatrice caught sight of a figure and pulled Salto up sharply, meaning to be cautious. But then she recognized Marisita's familiar dress, crumpled into a lopsided monument as she kneeled. She had Daniel's head and shoulders in her lap. Her arms circled him.
"Do you have his darkness?" Beatrice called.
"No,"
Marisita said.
This seemed impossible, as Daniel had broken the taboo by holding Marisita in her distress, and now Marisita was doing the same for him. And there was no doubt that she loved him. She was there, after all. And so she should have been an heir to his darkness.
Beatrice began to wonder if they had been wrong about the savagery of the Soria darkness along with everything else, and dangerously, hope trembled in her.
"How is that possible? I cannot interfere with his miracle,"
Marisita said with a little sob in her voice.
"Because it's too late. He's dead."
Now Beatrice scrambled down from Salto so quickly that she terrified even Salto. The animal leaped back from her as she hurried to Marisita's side and crouched in the scrubby grass beside her. Here was Daniel Lupe Soria, the saint of Bichoraro, worn to a frayed thread in Marisita's arms. He looked like all of the icons Beatrice had ever seen. The martyred saint, gaunt and frail, long hair hanging. Marisita was the Madonna, holding him close. Beatrice thought she knew then what Pete felt like with the hole in his heart. Movement to her right startled her.
"What's that?"
she demanded.
"His darkness,"
Marisita wept. It was a dark, pale-faced owl, standing nearly as tall as Beatrice. It was not the same owl that had hatched from the egg in the truck, but it was the same species. It was no natural owl, but rather an uncanny creature bred of miracles and darkness. Like the one Beatrice had seen hatch, its face was not quite an owl face. In fact, as Beatrice studied it in the pale light, she realized it had Daniel's eyes painted on it. Daniel's mouth, too. And Daniel's ears, painted on the side of its head, as if it was made of both owl and wood.
"It took his eyes," Marisita said. "And just when I got here, it stole his breath. I tried to catch it."
This, at least, made sense to Beatrice. She had been told her entire life that Soria darkness was a terrible and fearful thing, far stranger and more difficult than an ordinary pilgrim's darkness. And this owl, with its stolen eyes and mouth and ears, was a terrible and fearful thing. At least one of the stories Beatrice had been told was true. She did not want to get closer to the creature, but she took an experimental step toward it anyway. With a little cluck, it pranced backward. Not far. Just a few steps, its wings flapping, its expression perhaps jeering. Marisita gazed at it with loathing.
"I just can't believe he's dead."
"Until his darkness leaves, he is not dead," Beatrice said.
She studied the bird. It skipped from foot to foot like a boxer, as if preparing for her to make a leap for it.
"The miracle dies with the pilgrim. Why is there another one?" Marisita asked.
Beatrice tilted her head back to look at the other owl, the one she had hatched. Her thoughts flew up into the air to join it. The problem was that she needed to know where Daniel's darkness originated in order to know how to solve it. What was he supposed to learn from this owl, this lechuza, that had his eyes and ears and his mouth and his breath? It could not be easy, or he would have solved it himself already. Beatrice took another step toward it. It took another step back. Again with the hectic, hateful, almost playful skips. She took another step. It took several more back, getting a little farther away. That was the wrong tactic, then, Beatriz decided. She would drive it away if she continued to chase it. Beatriz wondered if she could strike it, but she did not understand the rules of its theft. She didn't want to risk injuring Daniel's eyes or his breath. She didn't think the owl was supposed to be defeated through violence anyway, as there was nothing to learn there. Daniel had never lacked for fight or bravery. Beatriz thought about what she had learned from the events of the week before. When she made assumptions, she came to faulty conclusions. She looked at the owl again, brand new, as if she knew nothing about it. She looked at Daniel, as if she did not know him. She removed all her fear of the darkness and all her grief at her cousin's lifeless body. Then she asked herself what this scene could mean if she had drawn no previous conclusions about it. She struggled to school her impressions to be free of fear or rumor.
Marisita, she said, what if it is not wickedly taking his breath, his eyes, or his face? What if it is just keeping them for him? Why?
Marisita's voice did not sound interested. She was losing hope.
What if it's only there to help him? Beatriz said. A teacher instead of a predator.
Marisita threaded her fingers through Daniel's spider-eyed ones.
My teachers never took my eyes.
Beatriz stared down the owl, and the owl gazed back at her with Daniel's gentle expression. It was not so terrifying when she imagined it as a teacher, something positive, something trying to tell Daniel something about himself. She took a step toward it, but again, it pranced back away from her, even farther.
It will never come to you, Marisita said.
But Beatriz thought she knew what Daniel's darkness stood for now. She did not like the conclusion she had come to, which is how she knew it was free of her personal bias. The lesson Daniel was meant to learn was that miracles were made to be interfered with. He was never supposed to be able to banish this darkness alone. His darkness was a puzzle that was meant to be solvable only by another saint.
I think it will,
Beatriz said in a smaller voice,
because owls are very attracted to miracles.
Marisita said,
who are you going to perform the miracle on?
Beatriz said,
myself.
Chapter 32. This was Beatrice's thesis. The Sorias must have once upon a time confronted their own darkness, in the same way that all pilgrims were asked to confront their darkness. Somewhere along the way, a Soria must have lost a taste for facing their demons, however, and either died before performing the second miracle, creating a legend, or merely stopped the practice in its tracks, proclaiming Soria darkness too difficult to tackle. And so Sorias forgot how to solve their darkness, and they let it build up inside them until it became too treacherous, with a handful of Sorias being struck down each generation, falling prey to years of backed-up darkness. The only way Beatriz had to prove this theory, however, was by testing it on herself. And if there was any other explanation, if Soria darkness was truly impossible, or if it had become impossible, Beatriz might become wood, like Daniel's parents, or blind and breathless, like Daniel himself.
Take Salto and go, she told Marisita. I don't know what will happen. I won't go, Marisita said. I endured my own darkness, and I will endure this too. Then take Salto and at least ride a little ways off so you can watch safely.
She waited until Marisita had retreated just a little with Salto, and then she went to her cousin. She tied her bootstrap to his wrist so that nothing could carry her away from him before she could give him back his eyes and breath. She called her thoughts back down from where they were soaring with the buzzards and the other lechuza, the one with the woman's face, the one who had hatched from the fire.
Then she peered at the strange owl still on the ground, the one with Daniel's face.
Do you have darkness inside you?
Beatrice thought of how Marisita had just overcome her darkness, and the twins, and Tony.
Do I have darkness inside me?
She remembered those owls sitting on the edge of the radio telescope, watching her hopefully, and she knew that she did. The miracle swelled inside her. The lady-faced owl dipped down low from above, finding the promise of the miracle irresistible. But that was not the owl she needed. She let her pending miracle rise even farther, huge and terrifying. It was such an enormous, backed-up miracle that it began to call owls as far away as Bichoraro and beyond. She heard their distant cries as they began to flap toward the scrub as fast as they could, hoping to get to her before it was over. The miracle grew so much that now, finally, the owl with Danielle's face could not resist its call. It hopped slowly toward her, as she had hoped it would. All of its evasion was gone. It simply wanted to be as close to this oncoming miracle as possible. She let the miracle out. Immediately, she felt darkness surge up behind it. If you have never had a miracle performed on you, you cannot quite imagine what it feels like to have your invisible darkness suddenly given flesh. It is a little like reaching for a step and finding there is no ground beyond it. The sudden weightlessness and vertigo make it seem for a brief moment like you have no body. But you realize a second after that you will be given this body back just in time for it to be dashed to the ground. It is not fear, but it is something people are often fearful of. So it is easy to see how the two are confused. Beatrice's vision began to narrow. She was going blind, like Danielle. Doubt widened. Doubt was not truth, though. It was opinion. She pushed past it to a fact. She needed to get a hold of the owl with Danielle's face before her miracle left her completely blind. As black curtains pressed on either side of her line of sight, she seized the owl. It was not a real animal, after all. It was only fear and darkness under her fingers, which seem solid only until you have them in your grasp. She tore Danielle's face from it, and sucked his breath into her mouth. She saw his eyes appear on her own hands, painted lightly, like his spider-eye tattoos, and she knew that she had taken his vision from the owl merely by touching it. It no longer wore his face or ears, so she knew she carried them too. The owl nodded to her, and Beatrice saw that it had wanted her to figure out this puzzle all along. She couldn't thank it for the lesson, because she still held Danielle's life breath in her mouth, and she couldn't let it escape until she reached him. So she simply nodded back. The owl vanished at once, with a sound like a wind kicking up in the distance. Above her, the other lady-faced lechuza swept low, right over Beatrice. The owl's wings brushed her face, and she just had time to catch a glimpse of how it was now wearing Beatrice's eyes. Then everything went completely black. She did not have much time. Now that Daniel's darkness was gone, the only breath he had was in Beatrice's mouth, and it was useless there. Lost in darkness as complete as night, she hurriedly felt along her bootlace to Daniel's wrist, and then from his arm to his chest, to his face. Leaning swiftly, she breathed his breath back into his nostrils first, so that he would not die, and then she pressed his eyes back onto his eyelids, and his hearing back into his ears. She did not think she could bear it if it was too late. Because Beatrice existed mostly in her own head, she was never generally overcome with wanting for anything that she didn't have. The things that made her the happiest didn't have concrete forms, which made them extremely hardy. Ideas couldn't die. cousins, could die. She wanted Daniel to be alive, and the ferocity of that wanting hit her harder than anything she had felt so far. She could not believe she had told Pete Wyatt that she didn't have feelings, that anyone would have told her that she didn't have feelings, because even if the force of her fear for Danielle's fate hadn't convinced her of their existence earlier, the force of her wanting him to be alive now would have. Danielle gasped. She gave herself only half a second of relief before she hastily untied herself from him. His darkness was cured. Hers was not. That meant that her second miracle could be interfered with, and even though Danielle's lesson was that Sorias could interfere with miracles, didn't mean that he was in a state to help her. "Give him water," Beatriz said to Marisita, though she had no idea if Marisita was still close. "Don't come close to me." "What should I do?" Marisita called. "Don't talk to me." Beatriz kept backing away, hands outstretched in the blackness. Above her, the lechuza's wings batted air at her, out of her reach. There were no more miracles for her to perform to draw it close, however. And in any case, she didn't think that she was supposed to solve her darkness in the same way that she'd solved Danielle's. This was about her, somehow. A lesson, not a fearful punishment. She asked herself what she had learned, and what she still needed to learn. Casting her thoughts up again, out of herself, into the dark air above her, wherever her eyes were, she imagined looking down at the pilgrims. From that height, she considered how they had healed themselves. She mused on how the Soria's real collective darkness was that they would not let themselves help others because they were too afraid of losing themselves, that they were so afraid of being open and true about their own fears and darkness that they put it in a box and refused to even accept that they, too, might need healing. And the longer they blocked it up, the more the pilgrims also blocked up, and the worse everything got, until husbands and wives parted, and siblings fought, and everything was terrible. But this was not the puzzle Beatriz had to solve, because Beatriz had broken the taboo against helping the moment she suggested interviewing Marisita. So her darkness must be something else. Now, for the first time, she truly realized how difficult it was to be a pilgrim, a realization Danielle had just come 2 days before, a realization that all budding saints should be led to. It was often so easy to identify the darkness from the outside, but from the inside, your darkness was indistinguishable from your other thoughts. It could take forever to learn yourself. Something touched Beatrice's hands. She flinched back, but the touch pursued her, and she realized it was another set of hands, gripping hers. She tried to pull back from them, but they hung on. "Beatriz," Pete said.
"You left,"
she said.
"I did."
He tried to, anyway. He had walked out to the main road, and he had even convinced a trucker to pick him up so that he could hitchhike back to Oklahoma. But as he thought about leaving the desert, he realized he didn't think he could actually survive it. He'd already broken his heart once that night, and he thought that if it happened again, it really would kill him. In fact, it was only love that had kept him dying from the first heartbreak. It has a way of plugging holes in the heart, even as it punches new ones. But he knew there wasn't enough love in the world to help him survive leaving the desert so soon after leaving Beatriz. And so, he asked the trucker to let him out. The desert was so moved by this act of love for it that it cast a wind that rose the sand and dust, and this amorous breeze rolled Pete head over heels over scrub and fence, and through dry riverbed, tumbling him through the night like one of its weeds, until it brought him here, to Beatrice. Once he saw her, he knew what he needed to do.
"You can't be here," Beatrice said. "You'll get my dark."